The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and I have got one of the true pioneers in a behind-the-scenes wrestling influential man. AEW producer Keith Mitchell is on the show today. He is a longtime wrestling producer who I actually met for the first time back in WCW in 1996. He was a producer for Impact for many years after WCW. Actually started World Class Wrestling with the Von Erichs back in the 80s, and he helped kind of launch ring music for the different wrestlers, video packages like the ones you see on a weekly basis. Keith Mitchell was the first to do both of those things and so many more. Keith is actually retiring after 40 years. He produced his very last wrestling show last week, AEW Dynamite's New Year's Smash in Jacksonville, Florida. So in celebration of his incredible and influential career, he's telling us stories from many of the events and shows he produced, both in the ring and behind the scenes. He's explaining the difference between a producer or director and a technical producer of a wrestling show and why he was never interested in the last two. Keith's also talking about his start in wrestling and specifically television production for wrestling, how he landed at WCW, what drew him to Impact and TNA. He's also sharing his AEW story and how he started with the very first show that happened way back in 2019 and how he came to spend his final working days with us all the way to the end of 2021. Keith's also talking about some of his favorite matches and performances, some of the funnier things he's run into and overcome in the business, so much history between Dusty Rhodes and Fritz Von Erich, David Von Erich, Ric Flair, David Crockett, etc., etc., etc. We'll also talk about the very last WCW show where Vince McMahon and Shane McMahon took over the company. So many great stories and historical moments in the career of Keith Mitchell. His retirement, his incredible career in the business, and we're celebrating that today on Talk is Jericho. And talk about celebrating, there are still cabins left for Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea, the Four Leaf Clover, setting sail March 14th. Got an incredible lineup of talent joining us. Go to book a cabin now at ChrisJerichoCruise.com and come rock with Fozzie and our new drummer, Grant Brooks, just announced earlier this week. Frank Fonseray stepped down and Grant is in and will be joining us on the Save the World Tour that is starting March 31st. This time we're heading west, east, central, all over the place. We'll even be in California starting May 5th at the infamous Whiskey A Go-Go. Tickets are available at FozzyRock.com. Don't forget about our legendary VIP meet and greets. It's one of the best in the business. Get your tickets and meet and greets and VIPs at FozzyRock.com. Go check that out. We are going to rock your socks off, and we're going to have a great time today with the legendary production pioneer Keith Mitchell on this day of his retirement right here, right now on Talk is Jericho. So it's a bittersweet day today because if there was a Hall of Fame for, I guess, wrestling directors, producers, whatever you might say, Keith Mitchell would be one of the top names in the business. So is that what you would say, Keith, a director? Is that
I'm the producer, actually. Tim Walbert directs AEW.
So
that's always been a misnomer through my whole career. Everybody has always called me the director. And I've only directed you know, 20 or 30 shows probably all total in the, you know, 40 years I've been doing.
So let me ask you this then. And what is the difference between directing a wrestling show and producing the show? Because you're basically at the helm as the executive producer almost.
And the producer, and an executive producer and a line producer are actually two different positions as well. A line producer is the person that sets up at the front bench, calls the show. The show doesn't start until he, you know, says roll tape or, you know, roll the music or whatever. The director is kind of the person that's taking you step by step through the trip. And the producer's kind of the one saying, hey, we're going to go to, you know, Dallas first, then we're going to go to Fort Worth. And then, you know, so it's, he sees the big picture and takes it kind of, and deals with the kind of behind the scenes, the music, the lighting, while a director can call cues, the producer's setting cues up, kind of working on the flow. So it's that you have to work hand in hand. It's almost like I always describe it sort of like a marriage. You know, it's an old couple sitting there and the, you know, the wife and the husband, and you're kind of, you know, you always have to have this camaraderie in this, you know, ability to work together, which I think Tim is awesome at that. He and I, you know, it's hand in glove. And there's, you know, several people that I've worked with that directed that are similar, but Tim is probably, you know, definitely one of the best, if not the best. But so if that makes sense, I mean, the producer is like, you know, for instance, for your entrance, you know, I'd be the one making sure you're in position, making sure the music's queued up, you know, and even probably calling your music. But Tim would be the director would say, he would be telling the cameramen what to do, because there's so he's calling shot by shot. You know, this shot's coming up next. He'll ready a camera, ready the chip, ready camera six, you know, have camera six moving. Then he'll dissolve to that, you know, whatever the nuts and bolts of the video that goes, you know, through the switcher. He's talking to the technical director who's sitting next to him, who's actually switching that, which is probably the hardest job on the cameras, show. Right. I can't even figure out how to. I started out my first job, I had to use one of those, and I decided real quick that was not for me. I didn't want to try to do that.
So how long have you been producing wrestling for?
You know, producing, that's a good question. I don't really.
Or involved in wrestling.
Involved in wrestling probably for 40 years, you know, close to that. And I started in my first job in television right out of college was a director at this little TV station in Port Arthur, Texas. And, you know, it's one of those places where people go and move up as quickly as they can. And as soon as I got there, the guy that I was hoping to learn how to direct and use the switcher and all these things, learned that from him. Well, he got a job in Houston and was leaving in like a week. So I'm there a week and I'm like the senior director and there's no way I can teach myself. So pretty quickly I realized there was no future in this. So I, you know.
So how did you get involved in wrestling then?
Well, I just found a job at a local television station in Dallas. I went back home and, you know, looked for a job and finally found one. Worked at night cleaning carpets while I gave me all day long to look for a job. And just, it was tough to get a job in television. That's why so many people start in the small market, because starting in Dallas is, you know, right. Next impossible. But so I got a job at the TV station, you know, very simple job editing film for the film department, and just started on the bottom. And luckily for me, the television station owned a production mobile unit, and the general manager of the station, you know, wanted to make a splash in the market by, you know, being the sports station. And it was almost like I don't know if you ever saw the UHF movie. I don't remember who was
Weird it. Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. It's very similar to that. And as an aside to the whole thing, it was owned by Pat Robertson. So it was owned by the Christian Broadcasting Network.
Oh, gotcha.
And so it was, you know, it was kind of a clash of cultures of ideas. Sorts.
Right.
You know? But so we did Southwest Conference football, basketball, you know, sports, and I was just lucky enough to be at the time when, you know, mini cams were coming out. We called them mini cams, mm-hmm. the portable cameras. And I, you know, got to be on board with starting to shoot that because I was, you know, I had a college degree and I was low man on the totem pole. And within, I don't know, a few years, I was running the whole department.
And so was World Class kind of the first wrestling company that you
yes,
got involved
yes,
with?
Yes, definitely.
So,
World Class.
So because we
were doing the, you know, the sports and everything, gotcha. The general manager wanted to make a splash. He and Fritz made a deal and we started, you know, doing the wrestling show. I started producing packages for it and everything. And, you know, pretty quickly started producing the show. And then, you know.
Well, let's talk about World Class because at the time, you're talking about 81, 82, 83.
Yeah.
World Class was very, very popular in Texas, especially Dallas. It was one of the number one shows in the market from what I understand, correct?
Yes, pretty much so. Definitely on the TV our station. And of course it was number one at its time period. And it didn't start, you know, it moved around a couple of different spots. It was on a Friday night. It was on a Saturday. Finally, it landed at a, you know, good time slot for wrestling, which was 11 o'clock Sunday morning, believe it or not. So, you know, there's not a lot of competition. But when I started doing it, we had like five markets that Fritz was already part of his territory that he was already booking, you know, San Antonio, El Paso, I think maybe Victoria, you know,
around Corpus Dallas,
Christi.
Of course. Yeah,
Dallas, Fort Worth. And of course, the other, it was a territory day, so it was, you know, that. But so, and we, you know, started syndicating the show. That we, the salesman that worked for the TV station, started getting other markets that would air the show, you know, and within, I don't know the exact time period, probably a couple of years, we were, you know, shipping 122. Shows every Monday morning. I would go to this. But
the rest shipping to 122 different markets. You're saying?
Yeah. And because we were doing so, you know, we had the remote unit, the mobile unit. We had a couple nice size studios, so we did a lot of other production. And wrestling was only every other week for me. Every other Friday night, I would go to this. I'd meet Tuesday after a taping or a shooting, and meet with Ken Mantell and Dave,
was he the booker?
Dave Manning. He was the booker. Yeah. He was the booker. Meet with Dave Manning and, you know, we'd go over the shows that were upcoming. I would handwrite the formats. I can't believe I had a stack of them when I moved to Georgia. I cleaned out the attic and threw them all away. I wish I had them.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So I'd write out the format. There'd be like, you know, interview or a package of music video we would, you know, do or whatever. In the meantime, you know, between then and the next taping. So we would go in and tape 2 1-hour shows and live to tape, which I think is truly live to tape, and as if it were, you know, but rolling
no
in all the no editing. So I would leave there on Friday night with 2 completed shows, put one on the shelf. The dubber would come in, load all the commercials, make 122 dubs, and ship them out Monday. And I would put the other one in my office. And the next Friday, I would do the same thing. In the meantime, we would do, you know, maybe music concerts or sports or whatever. So it took a little while before wrestling really became all I did.
Right.
And so that went on for even, you know, up until I moved to Atlanta, I was doing, you know, wrestling was one of many different
projects
clients that
on.
We had.
So if you're talking about the early days, it's still very much a kayfabe element. Were they letting you in on what was going on?
Very little.
Really?
Very little.
So what did you think? Did you kind of catch on to what was going
on? No, I mean, I knew, I guess I should say very little by only like the finishes, only not necessarily the build on whatever was happening.
Gotcha.
But you know, eventually it was a trust thing. You know, you just didn't build up that trust in a day.
Gotcha.
It took a little while and, you know, Ken would take me under his wing. You know, we don't talk about this. And I remember one time my brother came to the show with me, and Ken was like, afterwards he took me off to the side. You know, even families, you know, explain to me that basically you may not even be able to trust your brother. And you know, I mean, I got it eventually, but it was a strange time because my camera guys didn't know.
Wow.
And you know, one time Skandarak Bar was doing a you know, they were going to do a I don't remember who it was even with, but he was going to do a hair spot, you know, so, or, you know, a hair versus hair, whatever, eventually, you know, they're building up to it. And yeah. It started out with scissors in the ring, and it was time for somebody to grab the scissors after they've been dropped, you know, in the ring, whatever. And I can't believe I'm saying all this because I've never break kayfabe in my whole life, you know, but
it's 40 years. It's okay.
It's okay.
It's a different world now.
It's a different world now, but.
The scissors.
So we start looking for the scissors. They're not there. And I said, where are the scissors? And one of the camera guys, and I love him to death, said, I grabbed him. I was afraid somebody was going to get hurt. And I said, put the effing scissors back where you got them and never touch anything in the ring again. And, you know, I think at that point, they all just kind of started. I mean, everybody sort of knew, but sure. They didn't really. You know,
it's funny, right? Because in Japan now, 2020, they don't tell the camera guys or anything. And they'll catch stuff sometimes if someone's doing something that you don't want the cameras to see. But the camera don't know any better.
And the
director's not tuned in. It's like, you got to tell somebody or else you're catching these gig
I don't see how they do it without knowing. But
that's how it was 40 years prior.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So let me ask you this. You mentioned music videos. Now you were one of the pioneers of doing music videos and maybe even ring music as well. Kind of tell us about the videos.
Well, you know, I mean, the first music that we really played was probably, you know, Michael Hayes had, you know, entrance music and
Freebird,
Freebird.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dan Bynum, who worked with me, produced a lot of the music videos as well. He was my director at that time. And I made the one that everybody remembers is Carry on the Horse.
On the Horse, right. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a classic. You know, it was Conan the Barbarian movie, I go out to Fritz's ranch, and David has a house on the, you know, all the boys, I guess, had houses on the ranch. And so I go to shoot the horse scene, and David is like livid. He is so pissed off, and he calls up Fritz and is, God damn it, Fritz, Dad, horses are my gimmick. Yeah. If horses can be a gimmick, you know, and only in wrestling can horses be a gimmick.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of tension, David didn't want to let Carrie ride his horse. So we say, okay, you know, Fritz, I said, David, I'll come back. I'll do some footage of you, you know, cowboy riding horse and all that stuff. Calmed him down. Fritz calmed him down. So we did the horse riding and on the bareback. It was cool. And we, you know, in those days, you couldn't just go to a music or a video library and pull up a tiger.
Right,
you
right.
Know? So we as well. We'll go to the zoo and shoot a tiger. So my camera guy, you know, getting up there real close. Oz Coleman, love him to death. Best camera guy. One of the best camera guys I ever worked with. But he gets close trying to get that real tight shot of the tiger man, and he's lighting the shot up. And right in the middle of it, the tiger stands up to the side of the cage, reared its hind leg, and just sprayed him down, man. And tiger piss is some of the stinkiest stuff you could have. So the rest of the day, he's, bless his heart, he's having to smell like tiger piss. But so, you know, I mean, it's just stuff like that, you know. We just
Also, the Von Erichs at this time, Carrie and David, were rock stars.
Oh, yeah.
Chicks went nuts for them.
Yeah, it's so crazy.
You'd want to do these videos to kind of focus in on them.
Yeah.
To
build up the character with the whole rock image and the, you know, appealing to the young. Because, you know, as you know, in the wrestling business, if you get, you know, 16 to 22-year-old ladies, then you're going to get the 14 to 25, the 30-year-old guys, plus the, you know, everybody, all the hangers-on either side of all that age-wise. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of the plan. And
had you seen music videos in wrestling before? Was it something that you
No, I don't think so. We just kind of came up with the idea. There was, you know, a collaboration of a lot of talented and creative people, and you know,
kind
everybody
of based on like MTV being so popular.
Well, actually, this was basically probably. I don't think that we even had MTV. I know I didn't, and it was very young. In fact, I remember early on calling MTV. bitching because they were using some of our wrestling footage on a music video for George Thorogood.
Remember? Oh, wow. Yeah.
Man to the bone, you know, and I call him up and I'm bitching this guy like it really, you know, like it really mattered.
Right.
You know, but, you know, it's just a transition. Wrestling was becoming, we were shooting it like we would a sport, and that's all we did. You know, people think that it's all, you know, some great genius idea. We just did wrestling like we did sport, like boxing. You know, exact same, you know, same camera setup, handheld cameras ringside, you know, mics on the cameras, and playing show theme. And it's, I think the thing that really made our show work the best was my philosophy was try to make it like you're sitting in the front row when you watch this. It's a ringside seat to seeing it. So a lot more close-up shots, a lot more audience reaction, a lot more cheering. You know, the cool thing about the sportatorium was the Von Erichs came, walked in right through the crowd, you know, right down the middle of the people. We had the cowboys that came in with them, the guys, I call them the cowboys, that wore the cowboy hats. And you didn't want to get out of line with those guys coming down. You wouldn't see it on camera, but you would get like severely reprimanded if you didn't let those boys through, you know. But Fritz told me the story of when he was coming through, an old lady pulled out a hat pin out of it and stuck it, you know, all, as far as it would go in his thigh. So from then on, he was very protective of guys going through the crowd. But
it used to be the big thing, the old ladies in the hat pins.
Oh, yeah.
You hear that everywhere.
It didn't matter what territory it was. Yeah, it's probably some big lie. They probably heard it too. You know, it's wrestling stories. They get exaggerated, you know.
Just quickly before we move out of world class, you mentioned the ring music and Michael Hayes using Freebird. Prior to this, were guys just coming to the ring in total silence?
We usually start, pretty much. And we usually started... you know, the show matches with the guys in the ring. I mean, it was very rare, and it's so rare now, you know, although we're kind of doing it more, especially in AEW, to kind of get in the action a little bit more. And it's not a bad thing. It really, in those days, it was expected. You know, you didn't really build up those earlier matches. You just started maybe with the ring announcer in the ring, you know, this guy, that guy, blah, blah, ring the bell, you know.
So was it Hayes that had the idea to play the music?
Brought the music pretty much with him, and I don't think we were playing music for anyone else prior to him. Wow. I'm sure he would tell you.
But
and he would probably be right.
Then
you know,
thinking, well, we should probably get music.
For especially when we started doing it for, you know, music videos and.
That's amazing. And, what was the peak of your time in world class?
Oh man, well it had to be. And it was a real, kind of like today, very bittersweet. The day that Kerry won the belt from Rick, from Flair.
Texas Stadium,
you know, because it was the wounds were still raw from losing David, you know. And it was, and nobody knew in the truck. I was the only one that knew that Kerry was going over.
Oh, wow.
I didn't even expect it to be a backslide, you know. I mean, who wins a title match with a backslide? So somebody probably, but
you didn't know.
I didn't know the finish. I knew he was going over, but I didn't know the finish.
Wow.
And 40,000 people, man, just went crazy, crying. People in my camera guys were crying. People in the truck were crying because we'd gotten really close. I mean, David was, and I don't want to, you know. Big favorites, but David was probably the one I was closest to the boys, you know.
What was he like? Tell us a little about him.
Oh, man, he was very cowboy. I mean, he lived the cowboy. When we went, you know, he was going out of country. He was going to Japan. And before, when he came back from Japan, he wanted to have new entrance music. It was a song, Tanya Tucker's, When I Die, I May Not Go to Heaven. Texas is as close as I've been. So we're, you know,
wow,
shooting him being a cowboy, riding a horse, you know, all these different scenes. So we're taking a break, and me and a couple camera guys and him just kind of, you know, just sit down in his bedroom, and he starts pulling out all these different guns that he's got, this gun, that gun, and he was like, had like one of the first, you know, ARs I'd ever seen in the bathroom. And I can see he's sitting there, and he's, I can just see he's sort of starting to realize that, man, I'm sitting here showing all these guys, I know Keith, but I don't know, you know, I can see the realization coming to his face. It's like, man, I shouldn't be showing these guys all my guns, you know. So that he I could see that just this, you know, bright idea lighting up his face, and he jumps. He said, "This is what I do if marks pull up in my front yard," and runs out on the front porch, racks the AR, and starts shooting into this pine tree in his front yard. And my camera guys, they're city boys, you know. They're like, "Oh my God!" Their eyes get big around, you know. And he goes back in the house, and they're looking at me and looking at each other. They're like, "Man, this guy's crazy." And I said, "Man, this guy's gonna get his ass chewed out when his wife gets home and sees all the bark shot off his pine tree in his front yard, you know." So, but he comes back, but he comes up with this great idea that right down the road there's this old cemetery that, you know, has been on the ranch and old tombstones and everything, and he says, you know, let's go to the cemetery and, you know, shoot some footage. Which I'm thinking, hey, that's pretty cool, you know, the old cowboy leaning up against the tombstone, you know, with this hat pulled down, yeah. You see the silhouette, you know, it's a sort of a Western theme. Well, my camera guys will not go to the cemetery. So I have to go with the recorder, me and David, and we go down and I shoot up, set up different scene, you know, little shots of him walking by a tombstone and all these different things to use. And I went back home. Came back to work the next Monday morning, and I'm hanging out in my office. I think I might have been taking a nap on my couch in my office or whatever. The phone rings. I pick it up, and it's Ken Mantell saying, "Keith, are you sitting down?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, we lost David." And I've never looked at that footage. The footage, to this day, I have that footage. Wow. I've never looked at it. But I say all that to say that David was a cow. He was the character that you saw in the ring, man. I mean, he was a cowboy. He was a badass. He was a genuine guy. David was
a fairly good worker, too. The best of Von Erichs.
Best of Von Erichs, no doubt. Yeah.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
So what kind of prompted you to go, you've mentioned a few times, to go to Atlanta to work for NWA,
well,
WCW?
I turned them down couple different times during the years. I don't remember exactly when it was. And then it was kind of funny. They wanted me to come and talk to Bob Bartholomew, who was like Ted's right hand man. He was the president of the Braves and all this. So
okay.
I saw, and I didn't really realize who that was. So they picked me up in the, you know, in the big black limo and take me downtown Atlanta and CNN Center, the top floor. And then I'm going to the top floor and I'm walking out and here's, you know, Ted's office and all these. Here's, you know, the ruby slippers from Gone with the Wind in the showcase here. And I'm this, you know, this kid from Arlington, Fort Worth, Texas. Yeah, just what is going on here? But so I went in and talked to him. He was a very personable guy. And you know, we met, got along well, and went back home. And the next day, Bill Shaw, who you remember from like way on, you know, years later. But he was the human resources guy. And he called me up and said, "Hey, you know, you did well in the interview. Bob's interested, you know, blah." What they want to do is they want you to put together a proposal of what you would do to start your own wrestling company. How would you promote the pay-per-views? How would you, blah, blah, blah. And I'm you know. And at the time, I didn't really start putting two and two together yet. But I told
This is previous to Turner buying it.
Yes.
Oh.
I told Bill Shaw that I was, you know, in those days, someone that worked at the local TV station, the territory promoter always had an inside guy at the local TV station. I was Fritz's in Dallas. Wayne Daniels was the Crockett's in, you know, Charlotte. You get dubs done, you get all the stuff done that you need to get done without mm-hmm. having to go through the, you know, the upper management and whatever. But so, you know, you get a little cash on the side for doing
a little
that,
kickback,
you know, a little kickback, sort of, I guess. I was just looking at it as a per diem, you know,
sure,
a little per
course.
Diem, whatever. But I felt like enough of, you know, a relationship with Fritz that, you know, when I told Bill, I said, I'm not going to tell you how to, I'm working for a wrestling company now. I'm not going to put together a proposal to show you guys how to go into competition with and beat the person that I'm working for. I said, I can do those things, but I'm not going to do it and give it to y'all.
Right.
You're the competition.
You have to hire me.
You know, right. And not only that, I didn't even know if I really wanted to go there because I was happy in Dallas and the job I was doing because, you know, we were doing other sports, we had a football cowboy style. I had 2 field passes and 2 press passes to every home cowboy game. You know, we just had a, you know, just yeah. all the, just good perks and a lot of other SMU football and mm-hmm. things. So I turned them down, basically. And a few months later, like within a very few months, I was, got word that Jimmy Crockett was looking to do a magazine style show, you know, whatever, there in their offices were in Dallas. And I went and talked to Jimmy and I think I might have let the cat out of the bag a little bit at that meeting, maybe. In talking with him what was going on in the wrestling business. And you know, within a very short period of time, Crockett had sold to Turner is now buying, you know, Crockett Promotions. And after that, I met, you know, with Jim Hurd.
He was the head of the company.
He was the head of the company. Yeah, he was running World Class. And he called, you know, I got a call from him wanting me to come. And this was probably a year later, maybe. I think I first went to them in 88, met with Bill in like 88, maybe something like that. In 89, anyway, you know, Hurd called me. I came out, interviewed with him. I met him in Dallas, actually, because Crockett's, they still used
sure.
Crockett's offices that were there in Dallas. Yeah. But I went with him and you know, kind of decided it might be time because there was basically, if you lived in Dallas, there was this Dallas Communications Complex that was supposed to be the new, you know, production.
State of the art.
Yeah. Midway between New York and L.A. Because in those days, you either had to live in New York or L.A.
Right.
to work in broadcasting and to go anywhere. And Dallas was going to be like the in-between. But, you know, I kind of realized that because they sort of missed the boat on that. And Atlanta with CNN and everything pretty much took that mantle away from Dallas, and it just looked like it would be a good opportunity. So, you know,
In as kind of the head producer WCW.
Yeah, I think I don't even remember what my job title was, production manager or whatever, but basically I was in charge of television, which was a mess. I mean, there was just so much going on. It was, and by a mess, I mean just a lot of, there was still offices in Charlotte, there was an office
gotcha.
In Dallas, there were people, you know, still kind of scattered that hadn't really, you know, come together in Atlanta, and they were already building a little inserts studio down on the first floor. You probably remember the mm-hmm. our little, you know.
Yeah, I do.
That little room down there and a couple of edit suites, and I knew while they were building it that it was too small, but by that point Jack Petrick was, you know, running the show. He was the, you know, president of WCW or whatever.
Gotcha.
It was his vision to have sort of a tourist attraction on the first floor so people could walk by and see the wrestlers cutting promos in the studio. Like, you know, which the first thing I did was put up blinds so you couldn't see in the studio, you know. But it was a strange
did you, because you mentioned you come into WCW and you cleaning it up, and obviously it's early 90s was not a good time for WCW.
No.
So talk a little bit about that, and then when suddenly Nitro starts and just the whole concept of Nitro, because then it went through the roof. Completely opposite from what you had experienced just a few years prior.
Yes. And when you're producing a weekly, several weekly show. I mean, we had two hours on syndication worldwide in WCW Pro. We had 2 hours Saturday night, which was...
And that was the main show.
The main show, the mothership.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had Power Hour, which was like 9 or 10 o'clock Saturday morning. Mm. And then we had Main Event, which was Sunday night, and we edited a syndicated version of Main Event. So we were producing, when I walked into it, it was like a train going down the tracks at 90 miles an hour. And I had to jump on board and figure out what was going on. Quick. And, you know, just quick. Plus, you know, you throw in a pay-per-view here and there and a Clash of Champions, which were already up and
those
running.
Those were huge, too, absolutely.
And, you know, it was, and I came in at a pretty good time. They were, you know, slumping numbers, but... You know, they had a pretty good thing going with Flair and Funk and you know, the Clash of Champions coming up. So we popped a good number with that. I think we did a 5 or something like that. Or I don't remember what we did, but it was the biggest number they had done in a while. So just because I was there, you know, I got some of the credit, which was not at all, not at all deserved because, you know. I'm just counting backwards from 10. You know? Everybody else is doing all the hard work.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
So let's talk about them when you... Because I remember living in Knoxville in 94, working for Cornette, and WCW came to town, and they were giving out tickets with the phone bill. If you were on AT&T, it's like, here's your bill, and here's two tickets to the Knoxville Coliseum.
They couldn't pay people. At that point in time.
So how would you do that producing television?
It was horrible. Side. Yeah. I mean, it was horrible. And Jim Hurt told me one time, or asked me, he said, why is it that I look at the WWF in those days, show their video there, and they've got this big, you know, full look. And I look at ours and we got this big black stripe across the top of the frame. I said, well, Jim, that black stripe is where there are no people sitting.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was just dark.
Oh, I see.
So, because when you don't have something to light, you try to, when you go into an arena like that, you have two choices. You either light up the whole arena so you can see where it, or you make your viewer not be aware of the dimensions of the building or where the crowd ends by making it black.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, all of a sudden you're going to have, you know, 5 rows of people and, you know, bleacher sections of empty seats, So, and I mean, I remember one time we went to the Georgia Mountain Center in Gainesville. It'd be very discouraging because it's not an easy thing to set up to do a TV show. It's a lot easier back then than nowadays. But even then, I mean, it's a full day thing. People are running cable. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you don't have any people there. I mean, we had so few people at a Georgia Mountain Center taping that we canceled the taping. I think there were like 20 people in the audience.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to do like, I don't remember what shows we went. I don't remember how we worked around it, but we completely had to pull the plug.
It just looked so bad on TV.
You couldn't do it. It was all empty seats. And in an arena like, it's one thing if you're in a little studio and you're doing a studio show and it's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, you can look past the fact that there's no one there because it's a studio, but you're in a, you know, even a 800, 1,000 seat building, it's going to be very obvious that there's only 20 people there. And, you know, one of the worst things that you, I mean, if you're sitting there changing the channel and you come to something where there's nobody watching, it's like, you know, it's like
discouraging.
The viewer's going to change the channel. Yeah. They're not going to watch it because obviously it's very uninteresting because no one's there to watch it, you know. So it was a pretty good while before we started getting before. And a lot of that was, you know, when Eric came in, got things going with the whole, you know, the whole
NWO. How was it for Eric, for you, like, when Eric came in, how did that affect you? Was he hands-on what you were doing, or?
When he first came in, he came in as an announcer.
Right.
And I thought he was a great announcer, and still do to this day. I mean, he did. In fact, you know, he and I both, and Tony Schiavone, and I think David Crockett, and just a lot of us, you know, interviewed for that job. And, you know,
to be the head of the,
you know, and I told Bill that I said, Bill, I know what it takes to do this job. And I said, I don't think anybody that knows what it takes to do this job would want it. Because I sure don't.
Yeah.
Because it's going to take somebody that's, I didn't say this part of it, but it's going to take somebody that is willing to dedicate 24/7 to doing it. And I just, at that point in time, I had 3 kids, you know, I mean, I didn't want to work around the clock. And so he asked me what I thought about the different people. And, you know, I could tell that he was, you know, high on Eric. And I, you know, I agreed with him that Eric
was the guy,
not necessarily the guy, but I thought Eric could do the job because he's bright, young, you know. And I think there were several people that, you know, that could have filled that bill, although I knew it would be difficult for anybody. And it could be that Eric was the only guy that right. you know, and it doesn't matter because he's the guy that did it and did a damn good job of it, you know.
So how did that work for you when the company starts getting big? Because now, I remember I started there in 96, and there was a point in time where we did, 6 or 7 stadium shows in a row every Monday, it seemed. You know, it was very hot at the time. The cool factor was there. How did that affect your job?
I just was on the road. Yeah. I did a lot of traveling. You know, we would do, in those days, we were doing a pay-per-view a month. So there were every month, at least 1 week a month, you would have a live show on Sunday night. You would have a live show on Monday night. For a while, we were having Tuesday off and then live on Wednesday with Thunder. And then when Thunder moved to Thursday, we would have 2 days off. Yeah. And it would be, you were just on the road all the time. You know, I mean, it was at least 1 week you had 4 shows, and it was very hard. You know, I don't look back now. I have all my calendars from those days. And it's funny, I was flipping through them a while back, kind of reminiscing and looking. And there's a few dates. And as I flip closer to the NWO days, all of a sudden the calendar is just jammed full. I don't see how we did it because I did every show. I did all the live shows.
I found one of those calendars too from 97, and it was 24 days. That month, and that wasn't an anomaly. It was 24 shows.
I don't see how you guys did it.
Same thing.
It was tough on me.
How the hell are we getting?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
It was quite amazing to think back. And like you said, this is pre-family for me, so I really didn't have anything else to do but be on the road. So I knew it was a lot, but it wasn't killing me. But for you, having family and kids, it makes
And
it
I would land and go to the office.
Oh, right.
Because we were editing the syndicated shows.
Yeah.
We were, you know, I was scheduling all the production. It was like, I don't know how I did it. I couldn't do it at this age.
How about for someone, because we did something strange, let's say a Road Wild, those shows up in Sturgis.
Oh, those were so much fun though, man, those days. Because we flew into Denver and then drove to Casper.
Yeah.
And it, those days, Dusty and I were you know, traveling together. Oh. And one time we picked up his brother in Boulder, and because we had a day or two off, we went through Buffalo and rented a cabin up in the mountains and trout fished and hung out with Dusty and his brother and my traveling buddy at that time, Woody Kearse, who was a South Georgia character. So we would set up a ring in the middle of a field in Sturgis, South Dakota.
Parking lot or whatever.
It was a dirt field.
The field?
And the motor, yeah. And motorcycles would get all the, you know, all around it. I don't know, 15, 20, 30 deep.
Yeah.
And that's how they cheered, was revving the engine.
Yeah.
You could go up on the side of the mountain in Sturgis during bike week, and the whole side of the hills would just be shaking from motorcycles.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, the population went from like 10 to about 500,000.
Yeah, that's not an exaggeration either. That's true.
It's crazy. Yeah. But it was wild. I can remember hearing the sheriff talking about the, you know, on the radio to some of his deputies, the Hell's Angels were coming in from this direction. And I think the Bandidos from Fort Worth were coming. They were worried about where they were going to meet up. And I mean, it's just Wild West out there. It's pretty crazy.
You mentioned that you travel a lot with Dusty?
Yeah, a lot. We'd, you know, we would do a show and then you'd drive. You know, drive a few hours for the next town. And you know, he and I both had kids about the same. In fact, you know, my youngest son, David, played, you know, catch with Cody at the Columbus, Georgia Civic Center or whatever the name of the building was, you know. So we, you know, not only we were both Texans and, you know, had boys the same age and, you know, and what a character. I mean, he would just keep me in stitches, you know, for 200 miles. I'd be tapping out like halfway. Like, give me a break.
Was there anybody else that you were close to over the years?
Yeah. You know, a lot of people. Tony and I traveled together some.
Shivani?
Shivani and I. There were, you know, a lot of the different guys. We, you know, there would always be fun after the shows and
hanging out
afterwards.
So I mean obviously there's we're encapsulating years and years and years into this, but I want to talk about AEW and you've been the producer here since the start, and I know you did a long stint with Impact as well, but let's talk about AEW. When you first got the call to come here, how did you end up here and what did you think? Because you've been in the business even longer than I have. When I first heard the concept of AEW, I was like, yeah, whatever, let's see. And then you realize, holy shit, this is viable and it could be something. But this is before even we started having our first shows.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved and what did you think at first?
Well, first of all, I got a phone call from several different wrestling friends that, you know, hung out at
the Grapevine.
At the Red River Saloon after hours at Impact for years.
That's true,
and,
right, yeah.
You know, Kaz and Chris Daniels, you know, both called me, hey, you should talk to this guy. Well, you know that the wrestling business, there has been a rich person that's going to come in and change the business like every 6 months, like clockwork, you know. It's like,
you're
okay,
right.
This next guy, I stopped doing budgets in like 2002 because so many people would come. I'd put a budget to this and it's like, and then they'd never, you know. And names that you would know, wrestlers that, you know, I got this guy and put together this budget.
I remember
budget.
Toby Keith for a while. Someone brought that up.
Oh, yeah.
He was wanted by Impact.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Absolutely. But, yeah, and in fact, you know, Toby came to the several, and I think that probably could have happened. It was close. But so, you know, it's the pie in the sky. The rich guy is going to come in and start it. But so I told him, you know, and then Cody called, you know, and I mean, so I said, yeah, I'll be happy to talk to him. I always listen, you know. So he called me up and we started talking. Tony Khan calls me. I said, yeah, tell him to call me. Here's my number. So he called me up and we started talking, you know, and then I think he thought I was the director, you know, and I explained to him the difference. And so he called his partner Bernie and we had a three-way chat a little bit and hit it off pretty well. And he said, this weekend You know, Jaguars are playing at home. You know, come to the game, hang out. We'll meet on.
Were you still living in Atlanta?
I'm in Peachtree City, little town south of Atlanta, close to the airport.
Famous wrestler city.
Yeah. Lots of boys came
to this
there.
Day. That's true. Yeah.
So, you know, I go and go to the game. He comes. And I know he's a busy person during the game. I mean, he's, you know, like VP and got a lot going on. So he came up to the – I met him just briefly, and, I mean, he was in and out and in a hurry, you know. Yeah. And but the next day I go to his office and meet and we talk, and he kind of tells me sort of his vision for how – you know, what he wants to do, and brings me over here to Daly's Place because he has a dream of Daly's Place being, you know, a great venue, which, you know – Little did I know. But it's first of all, I wasn't real excited about doing that because a stage in a an amphitheater is not an easy
and also
wrestling
the big
venue
open section. Exactly. On the side, so what are you all the way across town?
So what are you going to do with all this? So but as a quick aside, I found out later that his inspiration for doing Daly's Place was an episode of South Park, which I can tell you know that. And sure enough, I mean, I got a frame from the South Park and compared it to I put a camera way up at the very top and gave him the exact same shot as the scene in South Park. But just his enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was just so excited. And I was, you know, after doing Impact for close to 20 years.
It
was, 2000. We started
from
putting
the start.
It together. Yeah, we started putting it together like November 2001. And then, you know, by 2002, we were shooting it. Mm-hmm. And so this was, you know, 2018, October 2018. So it'd been a long time. But so I was very interested, told him I was very, very interested and wanted to talk more. And as luck would have it, I go to do Impact the very next weekend in New York and come to find out the person that's head of their production was needing to move off the road. And not so they came to me, you know, talking about how important my position was at that point, how much they needed me, you know, and it was like, oh man, because I was just working,
right?
You know, we would tape four shows in a day, so it's short tapings and then be off. But so all of a sudden I almost felt like if I leave these guys now, they're not going to have anybody to do their production,
right?
And so I didn't just want to drop them, so I'm not going to say I necessarily strung anybody along. I just delayed making a transition as long as I could until, you know, working with the guys there, Andrew Thomas, who works for us now, was, you know, directing at that point.
This is prior to us even having AEW having a television deal.
Oh, yes.
Right? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And when I took the job, we didn't have a show.
We're
Yeah, exactly.
We're trying to do something maybe on Hulu or Netflix.
Yeah,
or something.
Tony and I were talking about that last night, you know, meeting with Showtime. The fact that when we met with Showtime, we didn't really, Turner was kind of backing off of the deal, and Showtime gave him at least the knowledge or the security that someone else may well be interested. It was a great time because, you know, it was the Fox deal. They were talking billions of dollars now and all this. All of a sudden, there's a lot more money on the table because you couldn't give a show away, you know, prior to that. Mm. And so there's a lot of money on the table. So
the longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
So when we finally do get started, and you are, so you were here from show number one, October 2nd, 2019 in Washington, D.C. You were there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even, I mean, prior to that, MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas was that.
Yeah.
I mean, that was pretty much a huge test for us.
In what way?
Because it's a new company. We've never really done a show at all. All we had done was that you know, pool party, press conference out by the pool, which was fun to do. And it, you know, it was a good show, but it was a test. I mean, we hadn't done that. I was able to bring together a lot of people that had done a lot of TV.
Because there's a lot of people here that I recognize from the years.
Yeah, I have, like, our lighting director, Jeff Bornstein, we've been working together since 91. Rick Fancher, who was, you know, here last night, I think he directed for and TD'd for me in 89, you know, and he's a great director too. Mm. You know, but prior to Tim being my director, he directed for Impact, he directed for WCW, he, you know, just was and still is in all likelihood a great director. He, you know, with COVID, he just, you know,
was that part of your role, was to put together the television team, so to speak?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
You're like the head of it.
Yep.
Wow.
And you know, Rocket came in as you know, our assistant director and Paul Spitzer, the TD, my son, mm-hmm. Matt's the audio guy. I mean, this guy's that you've worked with
sure.
for, you know, a long time.
Seen so many of these faces
and
before,
it's,
yeah.
You know, a lot of the team that worked for me all through Impact as well.
So going back to the live weekly TV now, did that, because you mentioned you were working for Impact for 20 years, but there was a short time when they did live TV, but now we're back, it's live, and there's something to it, because right out of the gate, we had a little bit of a cool factor, which is what you really need. It's what WCW had in 96, 97 to really sway people. How was that for you, being back on the road doing the live TV, and did you feel something special was going on right
now? Yeah, absolutely, without a doubt, right out of the gate.
You've seen it all.
I knew when we did, when, you know, the main, you know, the biggest part of this industry is selling tickets. Mm. And when MGM sold out in 30 minutes, I knew there was no doubt that this was going to be successful, you know. And I knew we could do the shows that we, you know, because Tony had the money. That's why she, you know, you get money,
money
and experience and passion, put those together, and it's success, you know. And the show, it was the show in DC, our first show. I brought the format from the show in Panama City. The last Nitro show to the first AEW show to show it to the president. And, you know, there were some executives in the TV truck, you know, on that night, and I was passing. I thought it was a good show and tell.
Sure,
you know,
sure,
good item.
Tell us quickly about that, about the last show in Panama City, where it was kind of a blending of WWE and WCW. It was
it was a bizarre day and night. Sean was the one that did the, I guess he was executive producer for Vince, came down and ran the show. And you know, it's the first time I'd ever met him. And
Sean?
McMahon.
Oh, Shane.
I'm sorry. I'm good friends with all those guys. I know all their names.
Shane, though.
Shane, my bad. It was the strangest night of my career, man, without a doubt. The only thing, and I just kind of just sat back and let them do. And funny thing is, the guy that directs for us now, Tim Walbert, was there that night as one of their guys.
He was a WWE guy, yeah.
Yeah, WWE guy. And but all I through the grapevine, I figured out that at the end of the show, they wanted to run a WrestleMania spot. I think it was WrestleMania. At some pay-per-view spot, it probably was WrestleMania. And they had the spot, and they were trying to kayfabe all of us. They didn't want anybody at the network. So at the end of the night, I tried to get my AD, who was talking to Atlanta with the countdown, and tried to. I would love to see somebody that the footage, if somebody taped it off air, to see whether or not they got that spot in, because I think I counted about before he got the commercial in, because I wanted one last,
to stick it to him.
Yeah, for on my way out.
So you knew that WWE was taking over.
Oh, absolutely. There was no doubt. And, everybody that was there from WCW, the people that were on staff, we were about to get. We knew we were going to get laid off, but a lot of us were going to get a nice severance package from Turner a month per year, And so I was about to get a 13-month vacation. I wasn't really, I needed it at that point.
Sure.
And we were so down and just the company had been for sale forever.
Yeah.
So
you were starting to get back to the point that you said before too, where there wasn't a lot of people in the audience, and it was the last legs. Yeah.
Yeah. The audiences had completely gone away pretty much.
Did you ever have any talks with Vince at all, or any Vince's people to go work for
WWE? Yeah. Multiple times. Yeah. When I was at WCCW.
Oh, wow.
In fact, Fritz bitched at me because I didn't take the job, because he said that, Vince had,
Vince a good spot.
Several things. The perceived attitude of the territory, whether or not that's true, I hear different stories from different people. Mm-hmm. Moving to Connecticut.
I was just going
to
say that. from Texas.
From Texas to Connecticut. My wife and I went up in February, which, it's not a good time to bring somebody in if you're trying to get them to move.
Trying to convince
Connecticut.
Them to
Don't bring them in February. Bring maybe, March or April or something.
Right.
And it was cold. And to get the house that I had in Texas on an acre of land and a nice house, it wasn't anything. Mm-hmm. It was like, five times what I couldn't have afforded the house that I was living in. Why would I move all the way across the country to live in a miserable climate and right next to New York City?
Yeah.
And live in, a house a third of the size of the one I'm living in now, So I met with Linda, and she was as sweet as she could be. She was like just a very, very nice person. And I,
But you worked nonstop anyways everywhere else. Last few things as we start to wind down, I wanted to ask you, what was it like? We mentioned the first 3 months of AEW were, it's the land of milk and honey, and we're living high in the hog, and then suddenly this freaking pandemic comes.
Yeah.
We're now, we're begging to have 20 people in the crowd. We have nobody in the crowd.
Nobody.
How did that affect you as far as shooting it? And
because
it affected us. I mean, it was tough to work in that situation.
I can't,
let's be honest, right?
You guys, obviously were the most adversely affected by it, with no crowd. But from us, there was several different things that was, the Zoom wall or this or.
We talked about having a Zoom crowd on a big truck.
And I was just concerned. I really didn't want to do that. And I don't know if I don't remember if I talked Tony out of doing it.
Why didn't you want
to
do it?
Because to me, it just felt like it would be canned. It would not be, I felt like we could get a lot better. It just didn't seem to me like it was, it would. come across well. Because
I was one of the guys that said maybe we should try a Zoom thing.
I know, yeah, we talked about that.
And we did talk about it, and then WWE did end up doing it in the Thunderdome, but it didn't work. It was, like you said,
it was too...
Mechanical people just didn't translate well,
and that's,
right?
Yeah. That was my concern, because it was difficult to mix the sound of the people, the look. It just would, to me, it came across as it was going to look real plastic, real fake, real, you know, not... That energy that I was talking about earlier about the crowd, you know, making you feel like you're sitting. You wouldn't have felt like you were sitting at ringside. You would feel like you were, you know, watching a video game or whatever. And so, it was a big transition. But I think the having the guys come in at ringside, you know, that the talent sitting at ringside was a genius idea. I think that was probably Tony's idea.
And they,
you know, brought in, helped out a lot of guys that, you know, were brought them in so they could work on dark and elevation. And
it made
such
a big difference, even though it was only, let's say, 40 or 50 people. But to have those people there, I mean, it really gave us a little bit of atmosphere, especially when the other shows didn't have that.
Right.
So even though it was only 20 people,
it was enough.
It was enough. And you guys, as we all learned together, you were able to shoot it properly where it looked like there was action, you know, energy.
Yeah. And it, and that's what was so ironic that I didn't point out earlier when we were talking about the first day I met Tony and he brought me over here and we, it's like, you know, at that point I'm thinking there's no way we can, how we're going to shoot this. And now we're really throwing a curve and it just worked. It was just intimate and once again, kind of letting you don't reveal the dimensions of the room that you're looking in. And by doing that, you allow people to suspend disbelief and they begin to feel like this is a full building because the dimensions aren't defined. You don't see an end to the crowd. So, you know, when
that's
you're shooting and it's, you know, I mean, shooting towards the stage, you know, it gave us the opportunity to lose a whole wall. Basically, we only had to worry about two now. We didn't have, because, you know, the fourth wall, the cameras are there and this, you know, if we had, you know, all of our sets and everything up there, which looked great because we have awesome scenic guys and you know, stage guys and Jeff Bornstein lighting it and, you know, all the different production people working their asses
figured
off.
Figured out a way to make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, but that's kind of the wrestling business though, isn't it? You know?
You got to go with the flow,
man. You
got to
go with the flow. You know, if you get in the way, you're going to get washed over, man. Yeah. You just have to go with the flow.
And we've said that for a lot of things. I remember laughing in Stadium Stampede, the first one where we had to finish like in 3 minutes or they're going to just shut the whole thing down because we didn't have any idea.
Yeah.
We show up there and we'll film it from 9 o'clock and it's 5 in the morning and we're still like,
what are we going to do next?
Torrential downpour for a couple hours.
Oh, yes. That threw a curve in the whole taping. That'll blow your taping schedule right out of the water. But yeah, I don't think that I've ever had to say we need to hurry up and blow pyro because the sun's about to come up. I think that's the first and only time I've had to worry about beating the sun.
But we did it.
We did it, and it was awesome. And it came across. It was well received. It was a, when we went back and looked at it, that's what's so fun about what we do. Yeah. It's like a lot of different creative people come together and, you know, add what their ideas and expand on it. And, you know, you have extremely creative people like yourself and, you know, Kenny and the Bucks and Cody and Kaz and CD and, you know, any number of different people that are doing, you know, crazy stuff. And,
So here we are today. It's your last day.
You
mentioned 40 years plus of experience in the business and all that stuff. And why is today the last day?
Well, because we were several different reasons. First of all, JR told me he was coming back today. And I wanted to see him while he was here. It kind of was closure with the whole Jacksonville thing. Originally, I was thinking about making Dallas my last day, but my plan sort of got pushed back a little bit. But just, my wife's been retired for 5 years. I'm ready to slow down a little bit work-wise and just travel and have fun and show her some of the, you know, places that I've gone and seen while she, bless her heart, awesome wife.
Yeah.
And we all have to have awesome wives. If we don't have awesome wives,
to be in this business,
if you find people that are miserable in this business is because they do not have a partner at home or traveling with them, you know, possibly that are willing to, you know, sacrifice as much as you'd have to do it. Because traveling and doing this is not, you know, it's not a 9-to-5 job.
It's not
you know, we I've said for years that they pay me to travel. I do the job for free.
That's right.
And we all say that.
That's right.
You know, but you know, I mean, it was time, you know, and JR and a couple other friends of mine told me when it's time, you'll know. And I just knew. It's like, okay, it's time.
So how do you replace a Keith Mitchell? Like, do you have somebody in mind? You don't have to give any names, but do you just kind of say, see you later?
I think that hopefully there are people that have done the job that I'm doing enough to, you know, there's two different positions. Like I said, the line producer, which is the nuts and bolts, you know, during the show, and then executive producer where you're making long-term decisions and such. And, you know, and I've told Tony, you know, call me, you know, there's things that I could still help out with and still, you know, I said I can
consult
from the ski resort in Brighton ski. You know,
right.
I tore my ACL there.
Yourself,
I know. Well, that was ironically the day before all the lifts closed in COVID.
Wow, where were you?
Changed the world. I was taking the ride of shame down the ski slope, being pulled down by ski patrol because I had torn my ACL and couldn't stand up.
What mountain were you on?
I was right below the Majestic. I was on the Majestic side
in
Brighton, Salt Lake City.
Oh, okay.
You know, the big Cottonwood Canyon. It's the one that's Silverton, Solitude, Brighton.
Yeah, because we were in Breckenridge. Same thing.
Yes.
We were supposed to be there for whatever many days, and Friday the lift shut down, and Saturday everybody out of the pool. We got 2 days of skiing in before it was out.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was not a good day in a lot of ways. We go to the airport, and you know, it's almost. It's like being in another country all of a sudden.
Oh yeah,
you know,
yeah. And that's how it was at the start.
It was just a flip of a switch. It was so bizarre.
Well, but we made it through. You know,
going back to just the whole start of AEW and what made me do it. You know, knowing that wrestling professionals with the experience and knowledge of Chris Jericho, Cody Rhodes, the Bucks, Kenny, were willing to, you know, jump into it. And, you know, I've known you for a long time.
96.
In fact, the most fun you were talking about, you know, shooting stuff and whatever. I used to like to do the location stuff when we would. And one of the most fun things I ever shot was when J.J. Dillon had disqualified or had he'd basically kicked you out of a WCW, and you were trying to take it up to a higher court, and we were going to find somebody in Washington DC that would listen to your case.
So funny about that is that it was in Washington DC, like you said, where the first AEW show was. You'd be at the building, the MCI Center, at I don't know, 10 a.m. I showed up there, and you showed up with your crew, and I remember saying to you, for example, so what are we doing? And you're like, I thought you knew what we were doing. And I was like, I thought you knew what we were doing. I was like, well, I guess we better go find something to do. And we just went out there and found a bunch of shit to do.
And we had this guy, I think the guy owned a liquor store, and I don't know what else, but he had a connection at every guard shack in DC. Hey, we would pull up and stop, and he would sit there for a minute or two, and he'd say, oh, I know that guy. And he'd go up and talk to the guy for a minute. He'd go, okay, quick, grab the cameras, and you got to move quick. Yeah. So we'd run up to the steps, you know, and shoot.
We're filming the White House. And I remember we weren't allowed to say the word president.
Yes.
You couldn't say president. You could say he might take your case, or he is in there at the time.
That's right.
But we're shooting at the White House, and you cannot film the White House. So it was very quickly for those shots where it's like, get it done in 30 seconds, or you're not getting it.
Right. Okay, exactly. So we would do it.
And we edited it together, and we put it on the show, and it's one of the classic Jericho bits. Actually got a lot
hilarious,
of
hilarious, man. Of and the best part was you trying to convince the little old lady sitting there protesting the atomic bomb.
I was a conspiracy victim, so yes, I was talking to the conspiracy experts on the front lawn of the White House.
And the crazy thing is they pay us to do that stuff, man.
Yeah, I know, what a way to make a living, right? Keith, last question for you. I mean, you've seen so many wrestling matches over the years. Is there one or that stands out to you as like the best one you've seen?
You know, that's a damn good question. And I still go back to it is because of, you know, a wrestling match. The purpose of, as you know, mm-hmm. entertainment is getting emotion out of the viewer. And I have to go back to the Carrie Flair match, you know, because there was so much emotion in the fans, in the talent, in the people that worked on it. I mean, it would be hard to beat that match for me just because, you know, I'd never seen 40,000 people in a wrestling arena. Yeah. Few had.
Yeah, you're right.
And to see that crowd explode and you know, I mean, it was a
magic
moment in, you know, that the next runner up may well be what set up the whole, you know, Von Erich Freebird Von Erich feud, was the slamming of cage the match. Cage match, and that was great.
It was the same show, wasn't it?
No, it's December. This was Christmas Day.
Gotcha.
At Reunion Arena, and the winner, I forget all the stipulations on it or whatever, but I think maybe if David was still alive then, mm-hmm. so I think that the winner, if Kerry beat David, there was some, you know, stipulation. Yeah. If Kerry beat Flair, then David got the title, because I think David was supposed to be
the next champion. And that's why they put Kerry in the position.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. So then, that would probably be one of those two, I think. How about you? What is your favorite match?
It's hard to say, man. For me, Undertaker and Shawn Michaels WrestleMania, when they had two of them, but the first one is probably the best wrestling match I've ever seen. I think it was 2009, maybe, in Phoenix. That one always pops into my head as my favorite. And then Savage Steamboat, of course, from WrestleMania 3 is a great one. I've seen some great ones here in AEW as well. You know,
exactly.
Kenny and Hangman versus the Bucks was a classic. I mean, there's been so many that you've been at, man.
Yeah.
So
it's hard to pick one.
It's,
and that's why I picked one on the emotion, the emotion that I had. You know,
and that's what you have to base on, like you said. So, dude, it's been a pleasure to work with you.
It's my pleasure.
And your first podcast, you did great.
This is my first podcast.
Been 75 minutes.
No way. No way.
Like that.
That's amazing.
Congratulations on a great career, Keith. And it's been a pleasure to work with you, man.
Thank you, man. I love you, man. Thank you very much.
Love you too, brother. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.